Did you ever feel like what you learned in law school didn't prepare you for the world of running a law practice? Law school didn't teach us how to start our practices the right way so that we could scale them into a thriving business. We didn't learn how to make sure that our businesses would meet our financial goals and provide the type of lifestyle we deserve. After 10 years, I was fed up with struggling in my practice and decided to begin a journey to scaling a successful practice that would actually allow me to finally live the life I've always dreamed of. I invite you to listen in on the conversations I'm having with some of the most successful solo and small firm practitioners, along with leading business entrepreneurs, and share how I am implementing what I am learning, all with the goal of helping you take control of your practice and your life. This is The Law Entrepreneur. Hey there, fellow law entrepreneurs. Welcome to episode 87 of The Law Entrepreneur. I'm your host, Neil Tyra. Today, my guest is Damian Turco. Damian is an interesting fella. He's an attorney up in the New England, Boston area. Previously, he originally started his practice straight out of law school down in Florida. And you're going to hear how he built that practice up to a thriving firm, and then decided he needed to return back home to Massachusetts and sold the practice in Florida and rebooted up in Massachusetts, and has now built that practice up to a very thriving and successful business. And primarily, you're going to hear him talk about how he did so through community involvement, particularly with the bar associations that he belongs to, and volunteer work in and around the community to get the name of Turco Legal out into the community and to leverage his presence to provide services in family law and other types of related legal work. So it's a great story, a thriving practice, and a very engaging fellow is Damian Turco. So let's get on with it. Damian Turco, welcome to The Law Entrepreneur.
Thank you, Neil. It's good to be here.
I appreciate you taking the time to be with us today, Damian. Tell our audience a little bit about yourself and how you came to be where you are today.
Sure thing. I've practiced law for almost 10 years. I've practiced in two different jurisdictions. When I first got out of law school, I moved down to Florida from Massachusetts. I took the Florida bar exam. And immediately upon being admitted to the bar down there, I opened my practice. So I was a solo right out of the gate. And I built a practice up down there focused on family law and also real estate transactional work. This was back in the days of the real estate crisis down there. So we built a whole practice around, or one part of the practice around short sale negotiation and kind of distressed property. I practiced there for a few years, built the practice up to 12 employees. We were helping a lot of people. And then wanting to go back home where I came up from, I moved back up to Massachusetts, who sold my practice down in Florida, and started again in 2011-2012 time period up in Massachusetts. And here I do almost exclusively divorce and family law practice. We have a 5-lawyer team. We have 3 offices in Boston, Newburyport, and Andover. It's kind of a mix between suburban and city practice. And I do a tremendous amount of volunteerism, both with the statewide bar association, the local bar association up in Newburyport, and with a couple other organizations as well. And I think that's probably going to be part of our practice today, but it's a part of our discussion today. But it's that volunteerism and leadership has been huge in helping build the practice up here in Massachusetts in particular.
Sure. Now, you started as a solo practitioner down in Florida right out the gate. Did you always know you wanted to be a solo? And if so, what's the story behind why?
I don't know that I really didn't always know I wanted to be a solo. I always kind of had like that entrepreneurial spirit. But when I finished undergrad, I didn't go straight into law school. I worked for 2 big corporations. So I was really in a corporate environment, 2 different like 100,000 employee type companies. You know, that was good too. And I did enjoy that as well. But I always had this entrepreneurial piece that I wanted to eventually be on my own. And I can tell you that I really didn't see starting a practice straight out of law school as a possibility, as like a realistic option, until I took a law practice management course in law school. Fortunately, my law school gave that course. Not every law school does. And
Most don't, frankly.
Most don't. Yeah. I know. And this is great because it was week after week of guest speakers coming in of alumni from my law school that, you know, talked about how they did it and how they were successful. And it really did a business plan in that class and heard from all these lawyers and got mentors, and it made it a real thing. And from that point forward, I knew I wanted to finish law school, take the bar exam, and start my own practice.
Where'd you go to law school?
New England. New England School of Law in Boston.
Oh.
Yep.
How long were you in the corporate world after undergrad before you entered law school?
I was in the corporate world for 9 years, but I was working full-time as I went through law school as well. New England has an evening program. And so, I mean, I had pretty good jobs. I was in HR, employee relations, for one big retailer. And then that was my first year of law school. And then the remainder of law school, I was in the legal department of probably the biggest grocery chain in New England. So that was a good experience. I kind of went nights and still had the structure of working in a corporate environment. So, I mean, there's definitely some transferable skills.
Sure. Sure. So you get all this corporate background under your belt, and you're going to law school at night, and you're fortunate that you have a law practice management course taught at your law school, and that lit the candle for you about going solo. So tell us a little bit about, so you graduated in New England.
Yeah.
But then ran down to Florida to take the bar down to Florida. What prompted that? Just getting out of the cold and wanted to chase the sun a bit?
Well, my wife's parents had moved down there, and that was a few years before. That was basically when I was going into law school.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, that kind of set things in motion for me to look at Florida and for us to think, hey, what's kind of pulling together our master plan of what we're going to do after I graduate from law school.
So here you take this gigantic leap. You graduate from law school. You go to a different state. You take the bar down there, and then you say, okay, we need a little more risk in our life. You didn't start a family at the same time, did you?
Yeah, well, I had a family. I had a child at the time. No, that's
good,
right.
Good gravy, you're a glutton for punishment. So
I know. People say, wow, that's brave. And I usually say, well, that's one word for it.
Yeah.
That's the polite word for it.
All right. So here you go. So you pass the bar, and then what did you do? Did you rent office space? Did you work from the kitchen table? How did you build that practice up to a point where you were able to sell it?
Yeah, sure. So that Florida practice, I was volunteering. Actually, I started my volunteer work before I had my results. I was volunteering at the state attorney's office, and I was networking, going to networking events. So I didn't have an office space at that point, but I had things mapped out. So as soon as I was admitted to the bar, which was a process of me looking at my results online and then walking across the street to the courthouse and getting sworn in, I already knew where I was going to be. So I went to a shared office suite where, you know, there's all these different businesses and lawyers that share this same suite. We share reception. And I had a very small little office, probably like 8 feet by 8 feet. And I started from there. And it was funny. I mean,
Department of Corrections might give you more space.
Oh my gosh. I know. And it's funny because I was really in the mentality of, you know, I need to make this work. And I need to do whatever I need to do to make it work. I was really networking a tremendous amount. I was taking on pro bono cases. I was learning law at the same time. It was a terrifying experience in some ways. But I realized I needed a paralegal who had some institutional knowledge of the court system in Florida and family law, which is what I first started out doing. And so I hired, I remember I was probably 3 months in, I was getting cases in the door, and I hired a paralegal. But when I first brought her on, I put her across the desk from me in the 8x8 office. That lasted like 3 days. And then we're like, this isn't going to work. But no, from there, I mean, it was just we grew, I learned, I was in court eventually every day, and built the operation, added the real estate side of the practice, and, you know, really, really grew things. There was a tremendous amount of distressed property in South Florida in 2008, 2009, 2010. That's when I was starting up. Some other lawyers were doing this, but the way I set things up were basically we were getting paid on those short sale negotiation cases by the lender. You know, the client was the seller. but we were putting our fees, you know, we were on the HUD and we were getting basically paid for the legal services representing the seller, and the seller wasn't paying anything out of pocket at all. And, you know, 99% of them, they were getting their deficiency waived, and they were getting, there's a Mortgage Debt Forgiveness Relief Act that gave preferential tax treatment. Basically, they weren't being taxed on the forgiven debt. It's really like a tremendous opportunity for someone who wanted to go out and hustle and build a practice around this area.
Well, it's interesting because even though it's a for-profit endeavor, I mean, you're getting paid for the legal services you're providing, it really is a community involvement and somewhat something of a an activist role, in that you were helping, you know, people who were underwater with their mortgages, and they're able to relieve themselves of that burden and move on with their lives. And the lender is happy to get that property back in their portfolio that they can then turn it around and start to develop it again. So it really is a win-win scenario for everybody.
Right. No, it was wonderful.
Yeah. Now, you started off doing family law. Did you have that in mind all through law school, that you were going to do family law?
Not really. It was...
Or was it more a litigation that you were...
I wanted to go into a practice area that I could reasonably get into the practice area. Like, I knew as a new lawyer with no experience, you know, working in a law firm, I wasn't going to be able to go out and do complex commercial litigation.
Sure.
But family law, I mean, most people handle their own divorces, so it seemed like an area where, you know, I could develop expertise, I could read up on the law, I could take some pro bono cases, and I would be a significantly better option than representing yourself. So that's really kind of the business opportunity part of it made it more appealing.
So it was a practical choice.
It was a practical choice. And I did make the mistake of thinking that it would be easier.
Yeah.
It wasn't easy. No. It gets super complex, but that's fine. It was great. And so it was really a nice way to start things.
So here you get kind of settled. You get a paralegal in who helps bring some institutional knowledge, as you said, kind of helps bootstrap you up. And now you're starting to take on more cases. And pretty soon that 8x8 isn't sufficient for you. So tell us about that journey as you started to expand your staff and move into new space.
Yeah, it was really an opportune time to grow, because we were building a business around kind of the bad economy in a way. And so what I did was I just expanded out in that shared office suite. So, and I picked up more offices within the suite itself. They had probably had like 30 offices in there. And I think I got to maybe 4 of those offices were the firm over the next 2 years. And then we were just outgrowing it, and it was no longer cost effective. So found office space that was our exclusive space down the street in a nice address, in a nice building. And it was beautiful. It had been built out by a high end investment firm, that had since left. And so we ended up getting, it was like 5,000 square feet. It was overkill how nice this place was. I mean, we had like 1,000 square foot veranda that overlooked the yacht club area. So it was kind of nice.
You're certainly sending out a message.
yeah. No, that's right. It helps build professional credibility in a different way.
Yeah.
To have your clients come in and say, wow, okay, these folks seem like they know what they're doing.
Well, and I think for a lot of folks, one of the questions they have is, you know, how do you go about increasing your staffing, and particularly how do you go about structuring a compensation plan? So for your paralegal, when you took that leap of faith 3 months in, that's pretty straightforward. You're paying an hourly rate. And did you bring them on full-time or part-time to start?
I brought her on part-time to start and then ramped her up to full-time eventually.
Right. But then you started adding more staff.
Mm-hmm.
What type of staff did you add after your initial paralegal?
So I added attorneys, and I did a combination of some of counsel, like contract attorneys, and then I hired full-time staff attorneys. I think at our height, we had 4 attorneys total, and the rest was support staff.
Okay.
But, and I've done a similar thing up here in Massachusetts. We have 5 lawyers now, to a different, you know, in each, there's different structures. Like, some of those are salaried full-time associates, and some are prefer to be hourly because it works with their life better.
Okay. So they work less than 100 hours a week?
Yeah, right. Exactly. Well, we live, you know, this is a suburban town is where our main office is. And so, you know, we have staff members that still have a significant amount of family responsibility with the kids, and they need a flexible schedule, but they still want to litigate. They still want to come have clients and go into court, and they're good lawyers. They just need, you know, something that will work with their schedule. So this, it works for me, it works for them, and that's how we do it.
I think that shows an enlightenment on your part, because there was a time when that type of flexibility would not be offered. And I think it was stifling to young attorneys. And I got to say, in particular, I think it hurt women more so than men, particularly who were starting a family and finding it difficult to manage that role with an attorney role when you didn't have people who would provide them the flexibility of a working arrangement such as the one that you've described. And you don't need me to pat you on the back, but you're to be commended, I think, for recognizing that. Yeah.
I think it's good for the business, though, too. I mean,
well, yeah, as you said, it worked for you and worked for them.
Yeah, I mean, it's no real skin off my back. I mean, I don't have the business model here where I get the associate in, I pay them the least amount as possible, and then I make them work as many hours as humanly possible. That's not the model we have here.
Right.
Yeah, no, that's not what we do. I mean, there's still plenty of firms that I think have that approach, but it's just not necessary. I want my folks to be long-term. I want them to be happy. And I don't really care when they do their billing, as long as they're in court, they're adequately prepared, they're, you know, effectively communicating with clients. And so if they need to run and see, you know, a kid's soccer game in the afternoon or go to a doctor's appointment and it doesn't impact anything else, I mean, honestly, who cares? Why make an issue of that?
Right. This episode of The Law Entrepreneur is sponsored by Market Circle, the makers of Daylight. Do you want to help more clients but don't have the resources? Do you feel overwhelmed by the amount of work to do that you can't even think about getting new clients? If this is you, I urge you to try out Daylight. Daylight is the Mac CRM that streamlines your practice and can save you hours of work each week. Daylight has helped thousands of small businesses, including my own, to manage more clients and cases without adding stress nor chaos. With Daylight, you don't need to fumble through files or notes to know where you are in a case. There's no more CCing your assistant on emails or passing around spreadsheets. Because Daylight now has a new team view that helps you see what everyone in your firm is working on. You can see everyone's appointments and tasks and easily schedule meetings for the entire team or a portion thereof. To learn how Daylight can help your firm, visit marketcircle.com/daylight. Be sure to let them know you heard about Daylight through The Law Entrepreneur to get a 50% discount on your first monthly subscription. That's Market Circle, the makers of Daylight. This episode is also brought to you by my friends at Spotlight Branding. I trust them to manage the internet presence for my law firm, and I recommend them to solo lawyers every chance I get. They built a great website for me, and they use video marketing, social media, email marketing, and more to keep me top of mind with my referral network. Visit spotlightbranding.com to learn more. They're even offering a free gift for podcast listeners, which you can access at spotlightbranding.com/TLE, as in The Law Entrepreneur. Spotlightbranding.com/TLE, brought to you by our friends at Spotlight Branding. So let's talk about the nitty gritty a little bit without, you know, talking about necessarily about numbers and rates. So for an associate who is, say, working on an hourly basis because they want that flexibility, are you billing the client at one rate and paying the associate a lower rate and you're pocketing the difference, or how does that work?
Yeah, I mean, it depends on the setup. So if you have an of counsel, like a contractor type staff person, we do have one here, it's really whatever that contractor bills on the case, then they would submit their billing to me, and they're going to get paid at their rate, and then we're going to bill the client for the higher rate, what their ordinary hourly rate would be. That doesn't mean that we always get paid. It doesn't mean that the clients don't miss their obligations sometimes.
That's another issue.
Yeah, that's a different issue. So that's how that would work. But then we have hourly attorneys as well. And that's a little different, right? Because they're actual employees of the firm. And if an employee attorney, you know, works 8 hours, I'm going to pay the attorney 8 hours, even if the attorney only billed, you know, 6.5 hours. So they're two different things. However long the client, the attorney is working, that's how much they get paid. And then the client's billed for whatever work is billed to them.
All right. So that gets to, you have a couple of different compensation models going on here. So how do you do billing? What's your workflow?
Our workflow is, well, first we use a practice management software. So everyone who
Which
comes
one?
In, we use Clio.
Okay.
We use Clio. Yeah, we've used Clio for years. So it works well for us. I know there's other competitors and kind of, but for our particular practice, it works. So every attorney and paralegal has a Clio setup and they bill when they do their work. And, you know, that's from the beginning of the case all the way through the end. In our particular office, our structure is the attorneys, there's responsible attorneys that are assigned to each case. So there's one staff attorney that is the lead on a case. It's that attorney's responsibility to bring the case from beginning to its conclusion. I will monitor all of our billing. I'll monitor the trust accounts and to make sure, you know, there's adequate funds and that if the collections needs to be done, I will play that role. Rarely does one of the staff attorneys step in and actually play a role of, hey, you need to pay more money. But I will do that. I'll play that role. And then we all sit, all of our team sits every couple weeks on strategy. So we'll kind of come together, the group of us, and we'll talk about the new cases that are in the door and, you know, strategy and what's going on. And it's before this judge and I have this particular issue. Has anyone seen this? And we'll kind of hash out strategy on the case based on all of our experiences. That works great. And we do the same thing with anything that's topical, anything coming up, you know, like we might have a pretrial hearing on, you know, a case that's before this particular judge. I'm not sure how this judge is going to react to this. These are the facts and circumstances going on. And again, harnessing the team to devise strategy.
So those team meetings, are you doing those face-to-face?
Usually we have them face-to-face, but if someone can't make it face-to-face, well, you know, that person can call in.
Right.
But they work best if it's face-to-face.
Sure. How then do the staff in your three separate offices, how do they communicate? Is it primarily via email or are you using other technology?
I really don't like a super formal environment. I like systems, but I will have a staff attorney reach out to another staff attorney, however that attorney feels appropriate. They can email that attorney, they can call the attorney, they can text. We all have each other's cell phones. It kind of just depends on the need at the moment, how urgent the issue is. But it's the culture of the organization is such that if you have an issue, if you want to bounce something off another attorney, just do it.
Sure.
Just do it.
And how about telecommunications? You have people work from home on occasion? Do you work from home? Or you, because Clio's cloud-based, so that facilitates that if need be.
Yeah, honestly, it's pretty much the same approach that I take with the flexible schedule. I really don't care so much if someone comes into the office or if they work from home or if, and I do it too. It just depends on the needs of the business. If you need to have a client meeting, if you prefer to work in the office, I think everyone in the firm has kids. So sometimes working from home is not the most effective way.
Right.
And everyone's, you know, assessed by their billing. So, I mean, everyone knows that. I'm going to take a look at the hours that they worked and the number of hours that they billed. And so everyone's kind of held to a standard of, you know, you can work from wherever you want. You can work for the most part when you want, but you need to maintain your productivity.
And you need to keep the client's needs in mind.
Mm-hmm. Oh, of course. Yep. No, that's right.
So then with this, you know, really interesting work environment, it sounds like it really facilitates a lot of interplay between your staff members and camaraderie. Tell me a little bit then how you go about presenting your firm to the public and going about acquiring new clients.
Well, first, I recognize that most practitioners of family law At least in Massachusetts, most practitioners are solo lawyers. They might have a paralegal, but they tend to be solo attorneys. And then there's like a handful of boutique firms around the state. But the fact that we have five lawyers, that we have that level of perspective, it's a competitive advantage. And, you know, and geographically, we're really the only ones in the greater Newburyport area. We're one of the few in the greater Andover area that has that type of approach that can offer that. I make it a point to present the firm, at least one of the points I try to make in our marketing and our branding is that we are a team.
So Damien, we spoke a little bit earlier about your involvement in the community and volunteerism as a means of marketing and presenting your firm. Tell us a little more about how that manifests itself in your practice.
You know, a couple things. One, I think community involvement and getting involved in organizations that you believe in, it provides so many benefits, and there is such a huge need in the world for more people to do it, that it's something that really every lawyer should be considering. I first was drawn to it because when I was practicing in South Florida, you know, I was out networking, I was trying to build my practice, I was trying to build professional credibility, and I saw a couple other lawyers that were, you know, probably a few years more experienced than me, but they were really crushing this community involvement approach and basically getting very involved in the local bar association and very involved in the statewide bar association. And what I noticed was everyone talked about them all the time. and they, you know, people talked about them in such a positive way, not about, you know, their business, but really talked about them in regards to like how much good they were doing in the world. I mean, for the legal community, for other family law practitioners, and for the community at large. You know, doing volunteer work, I feel like that's something that most people want to do it, or they intend to do it at some point in time. And so I always kind of in the back of my mind was thinking, you know, this is something I want to do at some point. I want to get involved in the community. Maybe I'll go work at a soup kitchen or something like that. But then I saw what they were doing, and it kind of came together, and I really formulated the plan. I did a bit of it. I did volunteerism down in Palm Beach with the Bar Association. But once I decided I was going to come back to Massachusetts, I really started thinking about how involved I could get up here. And so when I came back up to Massachusetts, I did. I started with one thing, and then I went to the next.
Well, tell me what those one things are. What are some of the examples of volunteer work or community involvement that you've gotten yourself and your firm involved in?
Sure. Yeah. And I should say, you know, for the listeners too, I admit I'm an overachiever when it comes to this thing. This is maybe overkill, but once I got into this, I really enjoyed it. And it's kind of it's a passion. So when I first came back to Massachusetts, I got involved with the Massachusetts Bar Association. That is like the statewide bar association in Massachusetts. It's not a compulsory bar association, so you don't have to join it, but we have like about 11,000 members across the state. And so I did what I think would recommend most people do when they want to get involved in an organization. And that's kind of, you just slowly wade into the water and you try to find an opportunity to do something. So I had known, you know, I developed a bit of an expertise when it came to law practice management from my experience in Florida. I knew really nothing about Massachusetts law when I first got back, except what I had on the bar exam. I guess maybe I did know a lot. So I went to a couple events for the Mass Bar Association. I joined the organization and I kind of networked to get appointed to the Law Practice Management Section Council. That's like a council of like 12 lawyers that it was within the Mass Bar Association, and their job is to pull together programming for law practice management type stuff. And so from there, I started doing programming, right? I started putting together programs, and then I started writing articles for the Mass Bar Association Lawyers Journal that went to all 11,000 members. And so, you know, I found myself going to like one meeting a month and then spending maybe 1 or 2 hours a month doing other types of, you know, writing the articles, putting together a program on, you know, marketing or networking or whatever. And all of a sudden my face and my brand was being blasted to 11,000 members on, you know, every other month. So, and when you do stuff like that, you start to get a lot of thank yous from other lawyers that read your content. And so from there, what I've found, Neil, is that once you start getting involved in an organization, like when you first you sign up, then you volunteer, and then if you volunteer and actually do something, you actually dedicate meaningful time, then you're really in kind of a very small percentage of lawyers who are doing that, and you're amongst other lawyers who really believe in community and helping each other.
But the community you're talking about here is the legal community. It's not the community at large. You aren't at a soup kitchen.
Well, I did. So after the Mass Bar Association, so I've done a lot of things in the Mass Bar Association, and now I'm on the executive management board. I'm on several different committees there. So I've kind of worked my way up. So I think that's kind of a good story for someone interested in getting involved there, that all you got to do is show up, work hard, dedicate your time. But I also, you know, maybe a year after I was back in Massachusetts, went over to St. Francis House, which is a day shelter. It's the largest day shelter in New England. So they help homeless people that, you know, they don't sleep there, but they go there for food and for counseling. And there's this program that helps people get back on their feet, help them get jobs, that sort of thing. So I actually, it's funny, Neil, because I went in there thinking that, hey, maybe I'll just go and do, you know, work in the kitchen and like serve one night a month or something like that. Because I'd always thought of that in the back of my mind, is that in my mind, that was the image of volunteering and giving back in the community.
Yep.
And then I got there and they gave me the tour. And it's this huge complex. It's like 9 stories. It's they help like, I think they serve like over 500 people a day. And well, when someone realized I was a lawyer, they said, well, we really could have you talk to a few people here who really could use some advice. And that kind of snowballed into, well, oh, wait, there's this huge need for legal services for these folks, for just basically consultation and advice. And so that turned into kind of working with the organization and setting up every other week. You know, basically, I go over there for 2 or 3 hours and sit down with one after another person that is trying to get back on their feet. And I'd help them with their legal issues. And sometimes that was just advice. And sometimes it was drafting a quick letter. Sometimes it was making a phone call for them.
What kind of legal issues are you seeing in that setting?
Well, when I was doing that, so I did that at St. Francis House for about 3 years. And then I expanded to other shelters. I don't do it. I still help those folks. The people in the organization still know to contact me when someone has a need. But I've kind of allocated my time elsewhere. But there were so many issues. So this is good for someone interested in pursuing that on their own, another lawyer. They have tons of legal issues. So many of them have criminal issues that they want advice on. Many have child custody issues because their children may have been removed from them if they had an addiction or if they were in prison.
Right.
Their children may have been removed. They might have child support issues and they need assistance. And, you know, these are the types of issues that if you do nothing, nothing changes. So there are plenty of folks that were homeless that were once successful functioning people in the world that had a child support order where they were required to pay, I don't know, maybe $1,000 a month. Then they went to prison, then they're living in the streets or whatever it is. And even though they had no income, they never went back and did a modification.
So now they got a huge arrearages.
Yeah, that's right. And there's folks with bankruptcy issues, collections issues.
So basically all the kinds of legal issues that you find anywhere in the community, you find amongst people who are down on their luck in homeless shelters such as this.
Right.
And of course, as a family law practitioner, you always have the opportunity to do pro bono and low bono work for people in need.
Yeah, there's no shortage.
Yeah.
There's no shortage. And in family law, I should say, you know, it's kind of a unique practice area where we see a lot of other legal issues kind of flow into our divorce and custody cases. You know, bankruptcy might be an issue. I'm not an expert in bankruptcy, but I know the basics. So I kind of had a good general background to do this sort of volunteer work. And you develop your network and you have friends in these other practice areas that when something comes up and you need advice, you pick up the phone and you call someone.
Now, how about your staff? Are they following your lead in this community involvement?
To a lesser extent, I would say it's really my passion. And I certainly don't force it upon them. But they do, each of the attorneys has their thing. I have one attorney that does community involvement, like a community group that the name is escaping me, the group that he's involved in. But yeah, they do their own thing. I don't force it upon them, but they're all, you know, somewhat like-minded that they see an importance in it. But, you know, I probably dedicate you know, 20% or more of my time to this stuff.
You know, and in this kind of environment that you're operating, does social media play a role? I mean, are you active on some of the platforms?
Yeah, sure. No, absolutely. I mean, I use social media to promote the firm, but then to also kind of raise awareness about issues when I can. And social media, I found, also is it's a good way to expand my network. I had someone this morning who is a contact in like the homelessness world. She has a wonderful organization called Blanket Me, where she actually goes out, collects blankets, and then goes out into the streets and hands them out to homeless people in North Shore, Massachusetts. And so, you know, her and I connected on Facebook and we've stayed in touch. And this morning she Facebook messaged me that she's got someone that has been rehabilitated or trying to get back on his feet. And he needs help with the guardianship. He needs advice. So I think it's a great way to stay connected and to expand your reach, particularly with those who aren't lawyers, who might just find you that way.
Yeah. Well, as they say, what goes around comes around. So if you're doing good work out there in the community, both for the community at large and in your legal community, hopefully that comes back to you tenfold. So, Damien, I want to thank you for taking the time to be with us today. I think it's a great story, and you're a great asset up there in the Boston area. Tell our listeners a little bit about how they can reach out to you if they want to follow up on anything you've had to share today.
Yeah, absolutely. Any of the listeners, feel free to reach out to me directly by phone or by email, and I'll give you the website as well. So the website is turcolegal.com, turcolegal.com. My email is Damien, that's Damian, at turcolegal.com. And you can reach me directly in the office at 978-225-9040. I'd be happy to speak with any of the listeners about this topic or practice management generally.
Terrific. Well, again, Damien, thanks ever so much. And I look forward to chatting with you again in the future.
You got it, Neil. Thanks to you. Take care.
Once again, I'd like to thank our friends at Market Circle, the makers of Daylight and Spotlight Branding, for being sponsors of today's podcast. Market Circles, as the makers of Daylight, provide the tool that I use to manage my cases, my clients, my calendar, my to-dos, the emails, and they do so all in one app that stays with me on my Mac, my iPhone, and my iPad. I use Daylight on my own in a solo environment, but you can also use it in a team. You can use Daylight to track the status of cases and delegate tasks to one another on your team, and you can see everyone's schedule all without having to interrupt anyone. Daylight is one of the tools that I use to stay organized, and it increases my efficiency. And therefore, it only stands to reason that it'll do the same for you and your team if you use it in a broader environment. So visit marketcircle.com/daylight to try Daylight free for 30 days. And be sure to let them know that you heard about Daylight through the Law Entrepreneur in order to get a 50% discount on your first monthly subscription. Also, our friends at Spotlight Branding, as always, have been very helpful in sponsoring this podcast. You know, I trust them to manage the internet presence for my law firm, and I recommend them to solo lawyers every chance I get. They built a great website for me, and they use video marketing, social media, email marketing, and more to help keep me top of mind with my referral network. So visit www.spotlightbranding.com to learn more. They're even offering a free gift for podcast listeners, which you can access at spotlightbranding.com/TLE, as in the Law Entrepreneur. So spotlightbranding.com/TLE to access your free gift. And as always, make sure that you visit our website, www.thelawentrepreneur.com, to see everything that's going on with the podcast and subscribe to our newsletter so that you can stay in the know and be the first on your block, so to speak, to gain insight into what's going on here. So once again, thanks for being here this time around. I appreciate your listenership. Hope to see you again next week on The Law Entrepreneur.